Then you will say in your heart, who has fathered these for me, seeing that I am bereft of children, and I am all alone, an exile, wandering around? Who has brought them up, seeing as I was by myself? Where were they then? That's Isaiah 49, verse 21, from the 2003 version of Yours Truly. Our daily scripture for today, little children. And we see, we might say, also nowadays, if we want to give it a modern rendering, we might say, where did they come from, right? But that's a very modern English expression. It doesn't really, we're not really asking the place of origin when we say, where did they come from? We're saying, you know, how did it happen that they are here? You know, like, or as it says in the verse, where were they then? Like, where did they come from? It is another way of saying that in the modern English, but we're not really asking their origin. We're asking, how did they get here? Or, you know, perhaps that's what is being meant by this, where were they then? Because he's saying, I'm bereft, means I don't have any children. I'm bereft of children, means I'm without children. So how could they be here? Because I'm an exile wandering alone, bereft of children. Why are there suddenly all these children who are saying they don't even have enough room to live? Like, that's what it said in the previous verse. The children had no room to live. And yet this Israel was saying, I didn't have any children. And where did they come from, in other words, is another way we would say it in modern English. But I chose to render it more in the literal sense of the original text. Where were they then? Similar to the American Standard Version there. When I translated that in 2003, that's the left-hand column there that you see if you're looking at that. So, continuing once again our study in the Ark of Urartu, chapter 6, we're at paragraph 3 now, where we have a picture here of Semiramis mourning for her husband Ara the Beautiful. In this beautiful illustration here, beautiful painting. Well, I don't know how beautiful it is, or how beautiful the lady in the painting is. It's about mourning. It's a painting depicting the mourning. It doesn't really look like she's mourning there. It looks like she's angry or something to me, but it's a rather interesting portrayal of a person mourning. But she was the queen, evidently. I mean, we would have to research this, because Semiramis was also said to have been the wife of the son of Ninus too. And so we don't believe that Ninus was, well, we believe Ninus was Gudea. We don't believe that he was in the family of Ara, who was a descendant of Haik, the Armenian. But now may we begin reading chapter 6, paragraph 3. The Armenian nation derives its name, that is, the name Armenian, as also appears true from the name itself, from Aram, the eighth from Haik. Note the distinction, in other words, up above in our table. Haik, Armanak, Aramasis, Amasia, Gigum, Sisak, Arma, and Aram, the eight. And they're not all father and son, because one is the brother, Arma being the brother of Sisak, So seven is the brother of number six on the list there. All the others are sons, I believe, on this list, but we'd have to go through every one and check. So there aren't quite 60 generations, but 59 generations, then we could say, or, but as far as distinct generations, 58 exclusive generations descended, in other words, after Hake, 58. Still a remarkable list. The longest one that we have from that time period, I believe, or I think we have a lot of other, actually we've seen that there are other genealogical lists, but very few from that time period. So, continuing paragraph 6-3, note the distinction between this Aram, the Armenian, and a son of Shem by that name. A son of Shem by that name. There was Aram, the son of Shem. In the Bible, he's mentioned in the genealogy of Shem. If I didn't even check, I could probably look at it. Well, before we do that, let me show you this. Ecclesiastes 2 and 25, for who eats and who drinks better than I do? Even in the study Bible, it says the same thing. Who eats and who drinks better than I do? Ecclesiastes 2:25. But if you look at on Bible Hub, I looked this up. And I'm not sure what translation this would be considered as. What is it? It's Clark's commentary of Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If you look at Clark's commentary here in verse 26, 25 and 26, he mentions it in his commentary on verse 26 and 25, which comes after the 26th verse. He says, for who can eat more than I, or as we rendered it, better than I, or as Jehovah's translation from Jehovah's Witnesses said. But instead of the translation here, which he spells in English as chutz mimeni, which means more than me, more than I, chutz mimenu, without him, is the reading of eight of Kennicott's and de Rossi's manuscripts, as also of the Septuagint, Syriac, and Arabic. For who may eat and drink or bring anything to pass without him? Coverdale said these things. I guess that's Coverdale's translation. For who may eat, drink, or bring anything to pass without him? Jehovah, in other words. So it's not necessarily who eats and who drinks better than I, but who may do anything without Jehovah is another way of rendering that, and I like that. I think, but it doesn't really matter what I think. It's about, because it's about Jehovah, and that's why it doesn't matter what I think, because it says, who does anything without God? That's a beautiful way of rendering that. Instead of saying who eats and who drinks better than I do, which is really saying the same thing, because he's saying, I'm a worshiper of Jehovah, and because I'm a worshiper of Jehovah, who eats and who drinks better than I do? Because Jehovah gives me all these things, because, you know, it enables me to drink. So if we, or to eat, you know, when it says drink, I take that as not meaning alcohol, because I don't believe in alcoholic drinks being healthy for the brain. And so, you know, even though some wine is healthy for the heart, it's not healthy for the brain. So I don't believe in alcoholic beverages, but who eats and who drinks can be rendered that way, which means that we can get a meaning from it. And this is what is hard to explain if you're not a believer. To explain to somebody, I used to think one way, or you know, when I was not a believer. But when you believe, it makes you aware that, well, wait a minute, if since I believe, and if there is a God, and I do believe, then there must be a good answer to everything. There must be a really good solution to everything. So I have to search for that solution because I know that God would provide one. So being a believer gives you an ability to work a lot harder than other people who don't believe, because you believe. You know, or when I say work harder, it also gives me the ability to get my health, because I believe, well, Jehovah must have provided me with the vitamins somewhere. In the world, there are vitamins. Jehovah's provided the vitamins somewhere for me to get healthy, because I believe in God, not because I believe in vitamins, if you see what I mean. Believing in God gives you more power to find the solutions, because you know you're not going to take the credit. You're going to give the credit back to God and say, well, I found it because I believed in God. That's, you know, God did everything. That's why I could find it. So faith in God gives you this power to say, well, who eats and who drinks better than I do? But it's because I believe in God that I can eat and drink as well as anyone, right? That's what it's talking about. That's how I see that. But Genesis, if we just jump to the descendancy of Shem, can we find this son of Aram here? From Shem. There it is, in Genesis 10:22. I thought I knew where this was. The sons of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arpachshad and Lud and Aram. So there's this son of Shem called Aram. He's not the same person as Aram the eighth from Hake. Now this Aram, son of Shem, established his posterity from Syria as the other Aram, being well known in the north and central part of Syria, such as in the city of Aleppo, the Ebliite term for Aram is army, or Assyrian is Arman. Aram the Armenian, the fourth great grandson of Hake, is said to be living during the reign of Ninus the Assyrian. So there we see the correlation to the time of Semiramis, who was either the wife of Ninus or the wife of, I think she was the wife of Ninus, maybe, possibly, in some ancient source. So that would mean she was the wife of Gudea, but, or in our understanding of who Ninus was. But now, like we said about Nimrod, the word Ninus could be a generic term. It could refer to the Armenian king at that time also, maybe, if he lived in that same area. It's hard to say what the word Ninus means, but Aram the Armenian was the fourth great grandson of Hake, and said to be living, let's see, this Aram, living during the time of Ninus or Gudea. Well, let's see if that works out, giving it, wait a minute though. That's fine. Giving its sixth generation run back from Ninus. He's the fourth great-grandson. That would be, great-grandson is three generations. So it should be seven generations, but there's a brother in that lineage we saw. So therefore, it's only six generations. And the equation is this, 2141 plus 6 times 100, or 21 plus 6 is 2741. BCE. That's Hake, the time of Hake. In other words, six generations before Ninus. Now, sometimes in the Bible, a generation means 100 years. That's what it means sometimes, because in the fourth generation, they will return here. Abraham was told, speaking about Israel's exile in Egypt, or their time in Egypt, in the fourth generation, they will return here. And it also said in the Bible they would serve the Egyptians for 400 years. So 400 years being four generations, 100 years means a generation. So that's why we're justified in doing that. 2141 plus 6 times 100, and plus they lived longer than we do. And Abraham had his son Isaac when Abraham was 100 years old. That's why all that works. But we get 2741 as the time of Hake. Six generations of 100 years, let's say, each, right? The six generations result from the eight being inclusive, right? Eight is inclusive, with one through eight. So we need, it's seven exclusive generations, right? So, because we don't include the first one. We're just counting from the first one onward. So seven total plus Arma is the brother of Sisek, and their numbers, he's the father of eight. So Arma is number seven, the father of number eight. And Arma is the brother of Sisek, number six. So Aram's the seventh on that list, even though he's the seventh exclusive generation. Aram, the seventh exclusive generation. Right? Wait a minute. But Hake, no, he's not exclusive. He's actually inclusive generation. Yeah, the seventh, instead of number eight on the list, he would be number seven if they were generations and we're not, if we didn't have the brother in there, right? He wouldn't be number eight, he'd be number seven, okay? That's all we did was we took out one generation because of the brother, and so he's number seven and Hake's number one, and that's why it's six generations difference between the first and the seventh. Six generations exclusive. Now, from page 19 of Mr. Advall's book, the name, Mr. Advall's book, we didn't give the title of it, but where is it? Listed here. Here it is. It's called The History of Armenia in two volumes by Michael Chamich, translated by Johannes Advall, Calcutta, 1827, page 17. That's the first source mentioned in this paragraph, actually. Also, and then from Mr. Advall's book, it's the same source for reference three. The name of the followers of Aram was Aramians. You see that? And that was later corrupted to the word Armenians. From Aramians to Armenians, the corruption occurred in the name. So Armenians are from Aram. Aram, the son of, or descendant of, Hake. Now Mount Ararat is said to be named for Ara, the son of Aram, the father of the Armenians. Aram was the father of the Armenians, and of course so was Hake, because he was his such and such great grandfather. If he's the seventh from Hake, then what is that? Grandfather would be, he's the sixth from Hake, exclusive, right? And the second from Hake exclusive would be the grandson, right? And he's the sixth, right? So he's the first great grandson would be three, and the fourth great grandson would be three more than the first, so that would be six generations. So the six generations difference is the fourth great grandson. He's the fourth great grandson of Hake, this Aram. If you want to get into great grandsons, here he is. Aram is the fourth great grandson of Hake, I said earlier in this paragraph. But if you want to get into cousins and all that, it's easy to figure out cousins. But not if you're not interested in it at all. It's very difficult to understand all the difference between family relations. But it's very easy when you understand what a cousin is. So I'm a cousin of my cousin whose father is the brother of my father. So uncles, my father and my uncle each have sons or daughters, and the daughters of the sons are cousins of each other because their fathers are, or mothers are, brothers or sisters, right? So let's just consider the male gender just to keep it simpler. When two men are brothers and they each have sons, their sons are cousins. Okay, so what's a second cousin? Well, that's simply when those sons who were cousins, they have sons, then those second generation sons are second cousins, okay? Now, so what's a first cousin once removed? Well, when those, let's say the first generation, could be any generation. When two cousins exist, they could be second cousins or first cousins, but or third or fourth cousins. But when the first cousins, when one of them has a son, then that son of that one is a first cousin once removed. If they were first cousin, if the parent was a first cousin. So two men are first cousins. One of them has a son. That son is a first cousin once removed of the other cousin, you know, of the one who didn't have a son. Or if they both had sons, then their sons, like we said before, are second cousins, right? Because they're sons of first cousins. It's very simple that way. But then if you have two second cousins, if one of them has a son, that's a first cousin once removed also. I mean, a second cousin. Well, in that case, it's a second cousin once removed. That's all. Second cousin once removed. It's just once removed. The once removed part just means there's another relation in another generation difference. Just a generation difference. The removed part just means a generation difference. So first cousin once removed. So would be like it's always back to the lowest common denominator, I guess you would say. Like you would say first cousins six times removed. That would be six generations after one of those first cousins, you know, would be first cousins six times removed. What if we went back the other way? Like I don't think we can go the other way, because if I say, if I'm a cousin of my cousin, we can't say, well, my cousin's father is my first cousin once removed, because he's not. He's my uncle, you see? He's my uncle. He's not my first cousin once removed. So it's pretty simple, actually, this relations between families, between, you know, generations and families, and how you determine. I have a sixth cousin. I'm trying to think if he's once removed or not now. I have a sixth cousin who's partly, possibly removed somewhat, but he's a sixth cousin who's in England, and he was the one who compiled a certain genealogy that helped me find my family tree. But I have a sixth cousin somewhere in England. And I found that out because of the fact that he produced this family tree that helped me determine that he was my sixth cousin. Yeah. He's not my first cousin once, or he's not my first cousin six times removed, I don't think, or anything like that. That would be a rather close relation, actually. But sixth cousin, I think, is what he is. I think that's true. Without mentioning names, but I think it's very simple to go back, and usually it's so simple, so great with the computers nowadays, with the internet, with Google, with all these features, with now AI is coming out and they're using it on Google, and it's going to improve. It's a wonderful thing. It's going to help us find the answers quickly, although because I've done research, scientific research, and a lot of other research when I was writing my articles, I did a lot, which was, it's all of it scientific in a sense, I guess, but a lot of it is, you know, literary research, right? Like research to find sources and things like that. So it's not all scientific research like that, or it's not all, like some science research is part of research and development, where you're inventing things. And I wanted to talk about design today, because I realized yesterday, you know, I was searching for some different colored snaps, because I'd made snap belts, or belts that you can unsnap and then take the buckle off and put a different buckle on the belt. Snap belts are very useful. So your leather, instead of using rivets to hold, or stitches, you know, to hold the buckle on, it uses snaps, so you can unsnap the belt buckle end of the belt, and take the buckle off, put a different buckle on, and snap it together, and you're back to, it only takes two snaps, and you're back in business with a different buckle. So I was, and I'm always aware that I have to be continually searching for the best materials if I'm going to build something like belts or anything. Anything I want to invent. I'm not inventing belts, but in a sense, it's a very small type of invention, because I have to design what the leather will be shaped like and where the placement of the snaps will be. You know, there's some design involved in making belts. Although it's a fairly small-scale design type, it doesn't require millions of dollars of research or anything like that. As far as the research and development, or as it's called, R&D, goes, it's just, I was looking for these different color snaps because I found these great snaps, but they're brass. They work. I tested them. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, what if I want to put a buckle on a belt and it's not a brass buckle? I want to get some snaps that are gun black or some other color. Gun black's just another color, looks like sort of a dull silver or whatever. So I didn't, or, you know, even sort of like titanium, you know, but any kind of finish you might want to get, or sterling silver or something, that kind of color. But as I was looking for these other snaps, I found some. I measured the ones I had, and I compared with the size they gave for these other ones, and they're close, but the other ones are slightly shorter. And every little millimeter, and even a fraction of a millimeter, makes a difference in height for the post of a snap to be able to be used with a thicker leather, so that you don't have to, you know, skive or shave down the leather to make it thinner where the snap is, so that you can get the snap to firmly attach through the leather, you know, because the length of the post determines how thick a leather you can use for a snap. So then I realized, well, wait a minute, I shouldn't go. Plus, it wasn't just the length of the post that was shorter with these gun black or silvery snaps. It wasn't just the post length. I also have never tried those snaps. I don't know if they work. They're from a different manufacturer. They're both called Line 24, which is indicating the size of it, or the length of the post, roughly. They're both called Line 24, but I can't trust that, because it's a different manufacturer. So I realized, what am I doing? Because it didn't make sense. When I thought about it, you never see the brass snap, because it's always either underneath the belt, on the open end of the belt, where the holes are. It's hidden by that part of the belt, or it's in behind where you can't see it. So it's always hidden. So what difference does the snap color make? Because it's a snap belt, you can always change the buckle to any color you want. So you can't change the snaps. So why do you worry about what color the snaps are if you're going to be able to change the buckle to a different color at any time? Doesn't make sense. But that, you see, we want every color to match. That's just the way we are. That's a good way to be. But as a designer, I have to be practical and say, wait a minute, I have snaps that work. I know they work. I've tested them. It doesn't matter what color the snaps are, because they're always hidden. I can put any color buckle I want on there, and it's still going to be fine. That makes me think I should order something here. What do I have in my cart? Nothing? Wait a minute. That's in the cart. Yeah. Let's see what it says. When will it be delivered if I order now? Oh, it's not going to be for another day or so. Oh, if I order in the next 30 minutes. I only have 30 minutes. I better order that. Okay, good. Got to order that. That's good. Got to remember to write it in my notebook. If I didn't do that, I would have had to wait another day to get that. I wanted to order more buckles. But the thing is, I was ordering some buckles that were not brass, and then I thought, well, how can I use brass snaps? But, of course, it doesn't matter, like I said, because I could later change that for a brass buckle or any any other color. It doesn't matter. That's the advantage of these snap belts. They unsnap, and you can remove the buckle. So the fact that it's brass snaps, that's maybe the best, because brass doesn't corrode, right? That's the best. But you see how human reasoning can come in. And designing something because we want to be as good as we can be and perfect, we sometimes forget the practical reality of things. So that's it for today's study. But I wanted to give that little example of how even a great designer, right, can make these really easy mistakes by thinking, well, this color should match, right? And then being mature enough to realize, well, that color doesn't matter because it's hidden. And of course, color matters if you're never going to change the part that goes with it. But because this is a changeable buckle, sometimes you're going to have a brass buckle on there. So the brass snap is perfectly fine. And that's the realization that a mature designer will make, right? A mature designer. Like, I mean, we see, and I really love the show that Jay Leno has on his YouTube channel now with Donald Osborne, the car appraiser, where they have a lot of banter back and forth about cars, and it's just where they're really talk a lot about design on that show, at least Jay does, and Donald talks a lot about the practical aspects of building cars, which is really closely related to the design. So there's a lot of interesting stuff and examples that can be brought from the car world into the world of design, and in general, that is, the design of anything can be correlated and, examined using the comparable aspects of automotive design. So, I mean, I love design. Cars are wonderful, but I learned I can walk to the store. It's better for me. And I walked to the store the other day, and I didn't have the hips. They didn't get sore, and my wrists got sore because I was pulling the wagon. So now, but then probably after one trip, now I had one walking trip of 2 miles return trip, and after that, my hips were fine on the second trip, even pulling a wagon full of stuff. So I don't need a car. This is the reality of it, because if I can't walk, I can't go to the store in a car and haul the stuff in and out of the car anyway. Anyway, it's today's study, November 4th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 23:33 hours Eastern Time. And this is Sissy, and this is Liv Dusty on my behalf saying, bye for now. That was the Ark of Urartu, 2, Chapter 6, Paragraph 3 today. Thank you for listening and watching. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. Sissy is a beautiful imitation, but a larger version of the Rolex, with the date at the top, the day.